Good afternoon. Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen, and thank you for joining us for today's address by Ethiopia's Minister of Health, Dr. Tedros. My name is Karen Meacham. I'm the Deputy Director of CSIS's new Global Health Policy Center, which we just launched last month. One of our objectives in this next period of the center is to build upon 7 years of work of our HIV/AIDS task force, but also deliberately to enlarge the dialogue around health in Africa. So when the opportunity presented itself to host Minister Tedros, we were thrilled, so thank you. We will have a series of high-level speeches of this kind as a regular feature of the center's work, and hope that as we move forward, we will continue to have active collaboration with friends and colleagues of Ethiopia. We are very pleased to co-host the event today with the Woodrow Wilson Center's Africa Program, and I'm happy to share the stage with Stephen McDonald, who's the Consulting Program Manager for the Africa Program. Steve has worked for almost 40 years in Africa on democracy, governance, and peacekeeping issues as well, so welcome. Finally, it is with great pleasure that I introduce Dr. Tedros, who's been the Minister of Health of the Federal Democratic Republic of Ethiopia since 2005. Dr. Tedros has served in numerous leadership positions at the federal and state level since 1986 and is known as a dynamic and innovative figure. So today he will reflect on the legacy of U.S.-Ethiopian partnership in health, particularly under PEPFAR, and Ethiopia's recent major health policy innovations. He'll also speak on Ethiopia's looming health challenges in the face of rising food and fuel costs, and we'll briefly discuss the impact of the global financial crisis, if he dares, I suppose. Please join me in welcoming the Minister, Tedros.
Thank you very much, Karen, and thank you very much, Stephen. It's a great opportunity for me, actually, to be with you this afternoon and speak about Ethiopia. I would like to try to give you a brief presentation, not more than maybe 20 minutes, I'm allowed, so we can have more time for discussion. And as what Karen said, I will give you first, actually, an outline of the reform agenda for the health sector, what we're doing under the reform that we're undertaking now. And then I will talk a bit about the relationships, Ethiopia-U.S. relationships in general and the health sector in particular. And finally, the current financial crisis, the food price hiking and the fuel also, which is really fueling some of the problems. So I would like to start with, first, as I said earlier, with the reform agenda. As you know, in Ethiopia, we have the Health Sector Development Program. It's our third phase now. The first two were 5 years each, and we are now in the third Health Sector Development Program and third year of the third Health Sector Development Program. In the health sector development program, we have started by identifying our focus areas. That's the maternal health, child health, HIV/AIDS and TB, and malaria. These are actually the major areas of focus, and if you take the three diseases in terms of morbidity and mortality, they contribute almost more than 80% of the burden we have. And health problems related to mothers and children are actually the most important and the areas that need attention. And that's why, although we don't ignore other health problems and other groups in our country, but we have chosen to start by really focusing, because we cannot really be everywhere, because if we try to be everywhere, we cannot be anywhere, actually. We will be nowhere. So that's why we have, in order for the planning and resourcing also, it's very important to focus for the wise use of resources. And then based on these focus areas, we have identified outcomes stretch targets, especially for 2010, to achieve by 2010, and these are related to the focus areas. And can I have a slide? I think I need. Yeah, that's very. So based on these focus areas, we have set some ambitious targets, and we have identified also our vehicles like the health extension program and health center, which is our primary health care, and also vehicles like the hospital. Then we have identified also some of the system issues we would like to strengthen to achieve our targets, and among long list, actually, the most important are the health management information system, which includes the monitoring and evaluation, logistics system, which is a complete the pharmaceutical supply chain, and the finance system that covers health insurance, and also harmonization and alignment. So these were the focus areas. And while trying to achieve the set targets by 2010, what we have done is we have actually embarked into a sector-wide health sector reform, which is part of the government's renewal program. The government had actually started its renewal program 5 years ago, and all government sectors are expected to undertake a reform, and as part of the government, the health sector is also undergoing sector-wide reform. And in the reform agenda, the main focus is capacity building, and the capacity building covers the system issues, human resource, and organizations, improving the organization. And we use it as a management tool, a business process reengineering. I hope many of you know Michael Hammer from MIT, who actually reckoned this management tool. And almost all sectors or government sectors in Ethiopia are using business process reengineering to reform their health sectors. And to reform our health sector, we started by outlining our outcomes, and based on that, the list that you can see, the core business processes. And in this core processes, the first one is the healthcare delivery, which is, we call it the main building, actually. That's the main house. And this one covers the mainly health promotion, disease prevention, and the curative services, mainly the service issues. And the centerpiece of this healthcare delivery is actually our health extension program. Health extension program is now becoming actually a brand for Ethiopia. We're trying to advance it because primary health care is, better than any time actually to really use it in addressing many of the health problems, not only in Ethiopia, in the whole continent, in Africa, and even globally. I think primary health care is the most important. And that's why we're aggressively expanding our health extension program. By 2008, our target was to train and deploy 30,000 health extension workers, and we have already trained and deployed more than 24,000, and the remaining 6,000 will be trained and deployed by the end of 2008, this year. So we're pretty on time as scheduled, and when we deploy all 30,000 with the remaining 6,000, almost each and every village will have 2 health extension workers per village, full-time, salaried, part of the civil servant, the first of its kind, actually, in our continent, compared to volunteers, non-paid workers, mainly deployed in Ethiopia in the past and also many other African countries. So we're institutionalizing, actually, the primary health care by deploying the 30,000 health extension workers and building more than 15,000 health posts in the country, and their main responsibility being health promotion and disease prevention. And the basic philosophy we're following in the health extension program is that if we can ensure through transfer of skills and knowledge to our families, to each and every family member, we can help these communities actually produce their own health. The issue is transferring skills and knowledge, but families can produce their own health especially the farmers, like, you know, they produce the agricultural products. So that's the basic philosophy of health extension program. So instead of relying for the health sector, you know, on the provider-receiver model and expecting the community to be at the receiving end, what we're actually doing is we're empowering them, improving their skills and knowledge so they can do it on their own. So the execution actually exponentially increases because you're actually giving the responsibility to the families to take care of their own health and to produce their own health. And the major focus of the health extension workers then is on health promotion and disease prevention, empowering the community, transferring skills and knowledge so they can do it on their own. So the healthcare delivery, as I said, is the centerpiece of all these core processes, and that's the most important one and the one that empowers our communities. And we're designing all the models in a way that really empowers families and communities to do most of the things with regard to health on their own. And in Ethiopia, more than 80% of the health problems are due to communicable diseases like HIV, malaria, and TB. And simple public health solutions can actually address most of these, the health problems related to these major communicable diseases. And that's why we rely on primary health care than any other higher program that we think cannot address our health problems, and which can be true also for the whole continent. And the other reform or core business process is the health commodity supply, which is very important as well. And the goal is to achieve efficiency, especially in delivering drugs at health institution level and through that to beneficiaries. And we have a revolving drug fund scheme here we're developing. And according to WHO, as you know, $2 per capita would be necessary to at least have sound, you know, program in terms of delivering drugs. And for Ethiopia, with around 75 million population, we would need $150 million. And it will take us, according to our estimate, 3 to 4 years from now to build the capacity of our new PFSA, which is the Pharmaceutical Finance and Supply Agency, to handle this $150 million worth drug supply chain. And there is also, this system is also centralized. Our lawmakers have already made it a law, so the agency is already established. And the main benefit of this is it's centralized and there is pooling in procurement that can create economy of scale. And that's also one of the new ideas in this model, the health commodity and supply. And we have tried to also design some of the process in a way that shortens the delivery of services from manufacturers right to the health institutions by cutting the unnecessary steps or handoffs, so the processes are lean and mean to really deliver drugs to frontline health institutions with an idea of non-stop shopping. That's like delivering drugs from the supply agency to the health institutions. So we have many new ideas actually in this health commodity supply core process, and we believe that that can address many of the problems we have in relation to the supply chain system. Then we have the research and technology transfer, the core process again. And one of the new ideas here is a target to produce 10 vaccines in Ethiopia, local production of 10 vaccines. This will cover the pentavalent vaccine for children, the 7 vaccines together. And in addition to that, a cholera vaccine, meningitis vaccine, and yellow fever vaccine that will be included as the most important ones for Ethiopia, the 10 top vaccines, actually, which will address more than 80% of our needs. So we're trying to focus because most of the health problems are linked with this one. So the technology transfer of this research and technology core process is actually, as I said earlier, to produce vaccines locally. But in addition to that, our research mainly, although we have the Ethiopian Health and Nutrition Research Institute, their research mainly was focused on the idea of publish and perish. And any research they do was not really focused on the community needs, something that addresses the community problems based on what the customer needs, rather on what the scientist needs, actually. And now they're really having a paradigm and starting the problems right from the communities and trying to do research which addresses the communities. Of course, there is no problem in aspiring to publish more, but at least you can strike a balance to satisfy the needs of the community that comes first, and also the needs of the scientist who wants to do research. So the most important paradigm here is how to kickstart, you know, the research agenda. It should be community-based, and our target is to have more than 95% of whatever research we do in this institution to be customer-focused or based on our community needs, and together with that, the technology transfer, I said, in terms of building the capacity to produce vaccines locally. And the other important element in our core business process is the public health emergency management, which is really weak at the moment, but with the new design, we believe that we can address many of the problems we have, because we have public health problems related to it could be drought, it could be flooding, it could be epidemics, and we're not well prepared actually to address this, and that's why designing public health emergency management is very important. And in this model, actually, we have tried to copy the motherboard in the CDC, Atlanta. By the way, many of these core processes we're designing, from the start, we didn't want to reinvent the wheel, because there are best practices everywhere, starting from our continent in Africa, in Asia, in Europe, in the United States, you know, North America, Canada. You can just find them everywhere. The idea is, how can you really benchmark or copy the best practices, pull them together and use them instead of reinventing the wheel? So we have actually a cocktail of best practices actually in each of the core processes, selecting the best we think from the country experiences elsewhere. And that's how we're just bringing all these designs together, and of course supported by many experts from many of the partners we have in Ethiopia. And in this public health emergency management, we have benefited from a support we got from CDC actually through PEPFAR funding, which we have already finalized now the design. And it covers the public health emergency management, covers the preparedness, the early warning system, the response, and the recovery. Almost all four important elements of a model for public health emergency management, and the design is almost done. The manuals are under preparation, and we're developing a new law, and which we hope will our lawmakers will pass, and we will have for the first time a complete design of public health emergency management in Ethiopia, and one of the innovative ideas actually in terms of addressing the existing problems. Then when it comes to other core processes like the human resource development, as you know, there is human resource crisis, especially in our continent, and it's not different in Ethiopia. And we're trying to address that. But in Ethiopia, the human resource problem, we don't see it like as one category, just a lump sum of, you know, what you call human resource crisis. The human resource crisis can be actually divided into several categories. And when we talk about crisis, we need to really say it specifically. I think it should be about the highly skilled. Otherwise, the mid and low level can be addressed actually. As I said earlier, under the healthcare delivery core process, the centerpiece of our program is primary healthcare. And for primary healthcare, the type of health workers you need are actually low-level and mid-level health professionals. And I don't think any country can complain about them, because they are not subject to migration or what you call brain drain. You can retain them in the country, and you can also produce a number of them, in a year or two or three. So based on our focus, the primary healthcare, what we have tried to do is we have identified the type or category of health professionals we need, and one of which is the health extension workers. We put our targets, like training the 30,000 I told you, and then we started training aggressively and at least satisfy that need, because we cannot have any excuse not to satisfy that need, because it's not, as I said, subject to brain drain or subject to any other reason, lame excuses. Then the number of nurses can be trained also. You know, we can satisfy that. We can train enough, and we have actually more than enough now, and we can produce them in big numbers in a short period, and that's something that we cannot really complain about. And the other category is health officers, what you call in the U.S. physician assistants with a first degree, and that can help actually in addressing partly the physician shortage that we have in Ethiopia. And even this category, they are not vulnerable to really migration or brain drain, and we have started producing enough and satisfying the needs. Basically, what we have based our decision on this is the crisis is because of supply and demand. There is short supply, but there is a huge demand. And to address this, we need to produce or overproduce in order to address it. It's like the inflation problem. When a huge amount of money hunts actually a small amount of commodity, and that's why, we're getting shortages also because of supply and demand. And unless we address that, we cannot solve the existing problem. And that's why we started producing our primary healthcare health professionals in big numbers. And by 2010, we can actually satisfy all our needs, and we cannot complain about health workers shortage, at least for primary health care. So to address the supply and demand, we designed a strategy of flooding strategy, overproducing, and also retention, incentive mechanisms to retain our health professionals. And we're using exactly the same category, actually, the same strategy to address the problem of the highly skilled professionals, that's the general practitioners and specialists. In 4 or 5 years ago, we used to enroll not more than 100, and 2 years ago, we enrolled for the first time around 250, and last year, we have enrolled 1,000 doctors. And in the next 2 to 3 years, we're preparing to enroll more than 8,000. And there is a good opportunity in Ethiopia because we have actually opened 13 new universities this year alone, and additional 10 universities will be opened in the next 2 years. That brings the total number of universities in Ethiopia to 31 from 8 at the moment. Actually, we had not more than 3 10 years ago, and you can imagine how higher education is expanding fast in Ethiopia, and that addresses our human crisis also to produce enough. Of course, people say it's the brain drain and, the developed countries taking health professionals from developing countries, which is causing the problem. But we believe that the root cause of the problem is not actually the brain drain. The root cause of the problem is the supply-demand issue, which is we're not producing enough. And if we can produce enough, we can address the problem. A next neighbor, Egypt, has addressed the problem exactly the same way, and they graduate 10,000 doctors a year. And from that, you can have enough to stay in the country and serve. And you wouldn't worry if a big number of them actually leave to work elsewhere. So to address the problem, we need to really overproduce, and of course we need to have retention mechanisms, incentives, both financial and non-financial, which we're doing in Ethiopia. But the major solution would be to produce, and this core process is one of the most important, and we're using it in addressing our problems in Ethiopia, and which is really, so far what we have seen is really something encouraging, and we believe that we're in the right direction in addressing the human resource crisis. Then when we come to another very important reform is the health insurance, health care financing. And our focus now is on social health insurance, which covers the formal sector. The strategy is finished, and the proclamation is ready, and it's sent to our lawmakers to start it in this year. And the other arm is the community-based health insurance. We're going to pilot that because that's the most challenging part, because that's going to cover the non-formal sector, the bulk of our community, actually, because they're farmers and self-employed, and we need to do piloting in order to see how we can really cover through community-based health insurance. We have tried to get experience from other countries, but many of the experiences we actually tried to share from other countries are not really successful ones. And we're trying to learn both from their success and from what they have actually seen as a challenge, and try to package it in a way in Ethiopia that will maybe ensure success. And that's why we're a bit careful in especially the community-based health insurance. But that's the social health insurance is a very important element of the core process, innovative idea, and the first of its kind in Ethiopia. And then the other very important element in our core process is the policy formulation, planning, monitoring, and evaluation. This covers health management and information system. With our partners, we have developed a new health management information system, and it stretches down up to the grassroots and draws information from the 30,000 health extension workers I told you. So its base is really wide, and you can get real information from our health posts or the health extension program. This is the idea. We are now rolling it down, and some regions have already started implementing the new health management information system. And for the first time, almost all our families, more than 15 million, will have family folders and will be followed regularly by our health extension programs. This is the whole idea. But it will be really bulky, and what we're trying to do is in the future to use information technology to really enhance the collection of data from the grassroots like the health extension program, because it's going to be extensive and manual collection of information will be very difficult. And of course, in Ethiopia, we can use the advantage of our government's venture now in the IT information technology. The target is to install 16,000 kilometers of fiber optics by 2010. 8,000 kilometers is already done. So when we have the 8,000 more in by 2010, I think that will cover almost the whole country in terms of connection. And we can use that infrastructure actually for the HMIS, enhancing and using it as planned, to collect real data from grassroots. Then we can have really accurate information on our health situation based on the 16 packages that our health extension workers actually are providing at community level. And the other important element in this core process is the international health partnership. Ethiopia has signed the compact, actually. Ethiopia is the first country to sign the compact, which is mainly on harmonization and alignment. Some people call it TAFLAV. And the idea is to have one plan, one budget, and one report. And we consider that as a process, actually. We cannot attain that at the moment, but many partners have already committed, and 13 partners have already signed to join this international health partnership, signed the compact, and agreed on a pooling system to pool finance for MDG performance fund, and also use one planning system and one reporting system that can minimize transactions. And many more partners will join in the future. As I said, we consider it as a process, so we now take any project-specific support, earmarked or other types of funding until we have this actually mature. And then when I come to the healthcare regulation, one of the, at least you can say, a good running system in Ethiopia in terms of regulation was the Drug Administration and Control. Otherwise, regulation in Ethiopia is very weak. You know, regulation facilities or the premises, regulating like professionals, licensing system, like continuing education, and that is not really strong. And regulation in relation to food, you can say it's like non-existent. And regulation of services based on, patient treatment protocols is also very weak. So what we're doing really in this design is we're pulling almost all regulatory issues together, and we're building one-stop shopping that really addresses the regulatory issues in the health system. And we got a lot of support, actually, from partners in the U.S. and some of the colleagues who came through a training program. PEPFAR support are in this house. I have seen Amaha and Dr. Fasaha, who have helped us in designing this new model. And at the federal level in the U.S., you have the FDA as a separate agency, and the other regulatory, separately. But what we have done in Ethiopia is to almost pull all regulatory issues into one, because the issue of regulation in the United States in one state could be equivalent to the whole country in Ethiopia, considering it in terms of the professionals we have, the number of health facilities we have, and we thought there is no need to really scatter or fragment the regulatory bodies, but it's better to house them in one and have one agency to look after all the regulatory issues. So, as I have tried to clarify, we have all these core processes, and when you bring them together, you can see actually some of them fall under service provider category, and others come under next slide. Another one, the health insurance, I told you, comes under service purchaser. And the last one I told you falls under regulatory body. So the core process actually come, and you can see these three arms of a modern health system being actually built in Ethiopia. And our reform actually covers all the three arms. And we have developed this year three proclamations that changes the service provider, the service purchaser installing health insurance system, and the regulatory body, the one-stop shopping for all regulation issues. So all three in play, and the reform covers actually the whole health sector. One of the challenges is it's too heavy to really push this massive health sector reform, because it covers almost everything, and we're trying to learn from it, because managing change is very difficult, as you know, and we're trying to be careful in addressing the people's side of change, not to focus mainly on the junk of design, because at the end of the day, the people's side of change is very important. So a few minutes, I will show you what we're doing in terms, the health indicators, are they going up, or are we succeeding, encouraging results, or are we going down, whatever. You can judge for yourself. It won't take me much, just fast. This is trend of health extension workers. As I told you, we are on schedule. By training the next 6,000, by end of 2008, we're done, and almost all our villages are covered. So you can see the high-speed training. And then this is trend in health post-construction, which is also sharp increase in 5 years. Then you have trend in counseling and testing, PMTCT and ART services, which is going actually fast. Then you have increasing trend of number of facilities providing counseling and testing, PMTCT. By the way, the 1997 is Ethiopian calendar, 2000 is Ethiopian calendar, when I speak today, I think you're 7 years, 8 months younger, so sorry for that. So increase in 4 years from 525 to 1,338, you know, the counseling and testing sites. And the rest also showing sharp increase. Sorry. Then as you can see, the number of clients, we used to test not more than 500,000 per year. In 1999, that's 2007, we have 1.8 million. And then 2000, which is 2008, 4.5 million. That's a huge increase, actually. Then I can give you the, I can show you the slides only. I'm the pictures. This is the number of people on ART. In 4 years, 3 years, 3.5 years ago, actually, paying patient, non-paying, you know, free ART, there were only 900 people. Now we have 150, more than 150,000 ever started. Of course, we had more than 7,000 paying, those who can afford. Now we have more than 150,000 free. This is support from PEPFAR, Global Fund, and the bank, actually, the major three partners in here. So how the indicators are changing fast. And then nets, as you can see, we were trailing from 1992 Ethiopian calendar to 1996. This is until 2004. Then from 2004, you can see the more than 18 million nets were distributed, actually, in 3 years. So that's fast, and the last 3 to 4 years is moving. And malaria incidence prevalence also declining, and deaths also declining. This one also for malaria, study by WHO and putting Ethiopia and Rwanda as one of the success stories now with regard to malaria reduction. And then we have TB detection rate, which is not really, it's weak. One of the programs which is not good in Ethiopia is the TB case detection rate. Otherwise, the treatment success rate and cure rate are better and within almost the WHO standard. And then you have postnatal care and antenatal increasing. Of course, the percentage of service supervised deliveries is low because many mothers in Ethiopia prefer to have deliveries at home and without assistance of skilled health professionals. And the contraceptive acceptance rate from last year is at 3% to 51%. This is one of the really success indicators we have in the last year. And then immunization increased 73% last year to 81%. So above 80%, which is a very important one in terms of herd immunity, and we would like to sustain it at least minimum at that, but the target is to put it above 90%. Then to show you Ethiopia's status, this is under 5, declined from 200 to 123. This is DHS in 2005, while sub-Saharan is at 158. So we are less than the average, which is actually good. But we need to achieve MDG. We need to have 67 per 1,000 live births. In 7 years, achieving that, of course, will be challenging. But with the fast expansion of the primary health care, I'm sure that we can achieve that one. It's achievable. It's doable. And then this is, yeah, then maternal mortality, it was 1,000 in 1990. And now, according to 2005 DHS, it's 673, less than the 871 average for sub-Saharan Africa. Still encouraging result for Ethiopia and a good news. But to achieve MDGs, we need to lower it further to 267 per 100,000 live births by 2015. This is the most challenging, where I am a bit, unsure what will happen, but we will try our best, because the maternal mortality, in addition to community-based interventions, which we believe will be strong in Ethiopia now, it needs facility-based intervention like the comprehensive and basic obstetric care. That will make it more difficult, but we're expanding our health institutions fast, and that will hopefully address the problem. These are some of the indicators, as I told you. And then when we come to, I just would like to say some words about the U.S.-Ethiopia relationship. As you know, the U.S.-Ethiopia relationship started in 1903, so that's 105 years now, more than 100 years, a century. And health has been one of the major components in the bilateral relationship. And the huge support that Ethiopia was getting, especially in the 1960s, was on malaria eradication, especially, that covers almost all areas of malaria. And by the way, what has been installed then with the support from the United States, it's still there, and that's why we have successful stories now, because we use really the same frame, but trying to enhance it more now. And then starting from 2004, it's the PEPFAR support. As you know, PEPFAR is the largest commitment ever by a single nation toward an international health initiative, which is, I think everybody agrees, the biggest. And that, I believe, this government has made history by really increasing support dramatically, and we need to be very grateful for that. And when we see Ethiopia's support, the support that Ethiopia got, it was $48 million US in 2004, then increased to 264 by 2007, and then 345 million by 2008. And I think it will be almost the same in 2009. But by any standard, this is really a huge support, and I'm really grateful and thankful on behalf of myself and my government. And in this PEPFAR support, we have now a new added, the PMI support also, malaria, which is almost $20 million. And we're using the PEPFAR and PMI support not only for health or HIV-specific programs or malaria-specific programs, but to strengthen our health system. And all the core processes I told you, the information system, the human resources, the healthcare delivery core process, the health extension program, health center expansion, finance system, the health insurance I told you, and the research and technology transfer, the BSL-3 level that was, the research lab which is installed by support from PEPFAR. Almost PEPFAR is covering all system issues of Ethiopia and building the capacity of the health system to better fight in the future, which is the best gift I can say. So we are very grateful for all the support, and the relationship is even getting stronger and stronger, and really, as I said, as I have shown you, making some encouraging results. There may be last point. Sorry, I'm taking a lot of your time, although I promised to finish fast. Too much to talk, maybe. On the challenges in the face of the rising food and fuel cost, I will make maybe a few remarks. As you know, the globe is interconnected now. The financial crisis is affecting many countries, but maybe fortunately, Africa's contribution to the global economy is not more than 2%. So I don't think it will affect it much, and that may be a good news. But what affects most, in Africa is the fuel crisis and the, the fuel price hike, which is going down now from 140 per barrel. Now it's going to 71, I think, today, which is a sharp decline again. I think if we can get a further decline, that's what we pray for, and that can help Africa and Ethiopia, by the way, because the finance is really a remote one. And the other is the food price hike also. In Ethiopia, the last 2 weeks, it's declining, and declined by 10%. But the fuel crisis was affecting almost all the whole economy in Ethiopia, because there is a construction boom in Ethiopia, and we need cement, we need to transport it, we need fuel for, transport our rebar, transport whatever our farmers produced. And I think the fuel was really the most difficult one. And the food also linked with malnutrition and so on is one of the problems for Africa and Ethiopia. But the financial crisis, as I said, may not be now, but in the future, especially linked to the aid could flow, that could be one problem. Because many are saying, because of the finance crisis, some leaders are indicating that they may cut the aid that they give. But what I believe is Ethiopia and other countries should really continue to reform their health system aggressively because it has a long-term benefit, actually, building our health system, because healthy population means better productivity, and that in turn means better economy. So in conclusion, I think if there is the political will, the finance crisis or the fuel cost and the price hike for food can be addressed. As you can see, almost all leaders of the West are really aggressively trying to address the finance crisis. And if this shows that if there is a political will, any crisis can be actually handled. The political will, I think, is very important. And the other issue is the finance crisis, many believe that was caused because of focus of investment on short-term gains. And I think it's very important to focus on long-term investment, and health is one of which. And I think when we consider about crisis, investing in health should always be a priority long-term investment that can improve our economies. So with this, I thank you for listening. Thank you very much. And sorry for taking your time, but I would be happy to answer your questions or suggestions, or if you have any comments on the design, the new designs we're undertaking in Ethiopia. Thank you very much.
Very well done. Thank you very much, Dr. Tedros. We forgive you for the length, because the comprehensiveness of that presentation was magnificent. And in fact, I imagine there are two presidential candidates, campaign staff, who might like to talk to you about healthcare initiatives and planning in the long-term financial crisis. You might have another job waiting you here. The minister has, as he said, agreed to take questions for about 30 minutes. We're going to, at your pleasure, use Chatham House rules so that if you don't want things to be quoted, you could say that. We'd like you to identify yourself when you ask your question. We'll take probably two or three, depending on how lengthy they are. Try to avoid long statements and make them questions to the minister. Okay? First hand I see is right in the middle here.
Thanks, Dr. Tedros. I thought you were going to say something about the droughts, malnutrition issue that, and what effect it's having on your health system. Samuel Adeni Jones, the Department of Health and Human Services.
Okay. There's another question. I see one right at the back there.
My name is Henok Fante from the Voice of America. About the global financial crisis, many are wondering if donor countries will continue their support to African countries. In fact, Kofi Annan was concerned, and he voiced his concern last week. Is this a concern for your government? Because in terms of the health sector, most of the plans that you have are based on outside help. So how significant is this? Another question, if I may add, is there is a new NGO law in Ethiopia in parliament, and some are saying that this may affect the work of NGOs in that country. So how will this affect the health sector, if it at all affects it? Thank you very much.
Okay, thank you. Let's take one more. I saw a hand right here. Yes.
Thank you. Vic Barbiero, George Washington University. In terms of the 24,000 to 30,000 health workers that are in place, how is the government paying for those workers? And are they employed? Are the jobs there? Are the slots created? How much is off budget? How much is on budget? I wonder if you could share your thoughts on that one.
Okay, Mr. Minister, you want to tackle those before we go for another round?
Thank you very much. I think with the drought at the moment, We have now around 6.4 million people affected. And as you said, you know, one of the problems, health-related problems, is malnutrition, and we're trying to address that. And especially now, you know, it's the harvest season, and we expect the impact to be reduced. But we are working with the relevant sectors actually in addressing the malnutrition issue. And the good thing now is we have the health extension program, and the more than 24,000 health extension workers in the villages, and they can do the assessment at the village level, and there is early detection and also referral to higher level to support kids who are most affected by the drought. So that institution is really helping now because it's already on the grass roots. And the other, with the financial crisis, I think I have also heard, you know, some leaders say that they may not really keep up the pledges they had, you know, in increasing aid to Africa, especially, not only health, but aid in general. I think, I don't think we can say you should give priority to us rather than, you know, to whatever problem they have in their, you know, domestic problem. It's understandable, and they can only support within something that they can actually support. But it's natural that they will try to address their own problem first. But while addressing their problem, I think if there is a way to address the global problem, there is, as I said, if there is a political will, there is a possibility of addressing both, actually. The good thing in Ethiopia is we're focusing on the primary health care. And the bulk of the primary health care can be done, actually, especially the health extension program at not at zero cost, but at least at low cost. And focusing on primary health care not only helps in getting, you know, better results in relation to MDG by involving the communities, but in addition to that, you know, the cost is expected to be lower. So although it could be a concern for many countries in Africa, but we also understand that countries should really try to keep a balance of their domestic and the global needs. And I wouldn't be surprised, and it will be true, if they focus on their domestic and try to address the global issue as well. But we would like to continue, especially in Ethiopia, heavily investing on building, especially the primary health care, building the health system. That is, as I said earlier, preferred investment in terms of the future. Then when I come to the NGO law, I don't think it will affect, actually. We're only saying NGO and civil society are two different things. And NGOs can get, as you know, can be involved in the health sector and can provide services to those who need it. Then the civil society are different from NGO because they can be involved actually in the political issues in the country, and they're different, as I said, from NGOs because they are actually are developed or established around a certain interest they want to advance, and they should be freely involved in the politics or in the development of the democracy of the country. And we're not trying to have this law to minimize the involvement of the NGOs, but it's to separate NGOs from civil society and to give more chance, actually, for the civil society to be involved in the development of in the advancement and development of democracy in the country. But NGOs can involve as free as they can, but NGOs, especially who get more than 10% of their funding from outside, and also NGOs who are run by foreigners cannot be involved in politics. And that's same true, actually, in any country to have healthy politics, because politics and democracy is actually reserved for citizens. So we didn't have any regulation before, and we're trying to regulate it. Although some people say you're trying to criminalize it, that's not the issue. We're trying to regulate it, and it's true from the experiences we got from many other countries. They try to regulate it, and NGOs and civil societies are two different categories, and we want to empower civil societies to be involved, to be engaged in the politics of the country without any restriction, and that's why we needed the delimitation and the differentiation between the two categories. Then with the health extension workers, they're full-time, by the way, civil servants paid by the government and full-time working for the health sector. And that's why I said this is innovative and new, and not only to Ethiopia, but many countries in our continent. And institutionalizing, it's actually part of capacity building and institutionalizing our health system at grassroots level, close to the communities. We believe that can have a huge impact.
But the question, I think, was who pays for the healthcare workers?
The government base. Okay. Government base. Yes.
Okay, thank you. Another set of questions. One right there will come.
It's Charles Teller from Population Reference Bureau, and also 15 years of teaching at Addis Ababa University. I want to comment on some of the analysis of your data on your trends, because some of your trends are very impressive, and they have been supported by, again, U.S.-Ethiopian collaboration in data collection, which is the DHS, and even your 1990 figure is UNFPA, U.S. Support. So you have positive trends in under 5 mortality, particularly in the last, in the 2000-2005, before your HEP system got up in place. Why do you think there was such dramatic improvement in under 5 mortality in that period when you were facing three droughts and two famines, the 1999-2000 famine and the 2002-2003. Yet with that, you had significant decrease. You also have very low prevalence of HIV/AIDS, and it's kept stay low. Your stunting has also gone way down from 1990 to 2005, while it's still high. So you have three major successes there. It would be good for you to comment on in fact, why they have been successes. But my question, though, is you didn't mention malnutrition in your talk. And you do have still 12 to 15 million who are chronically food insecure and suffering this year, according to your government. What do you think your strengthened health extension package can do to mitigate the malnutrition problem in the country?
Okay, next question is right here.
Dr. Tedros Amasiganalu, it's always a pleasure to hear you talk. Dr. Jacobs from USAID Washington here in maternal and child health now. My question for you goes back to the health extension workers, and this is a program that has evolved and really has unfolded very nicely. We are at a very different point now than we were, say, in 2004. But there are, I would say, three issues related to health extension workers that it would be nice, and I was expecting to hear more from you about, because we are at a different point. And one is the tasks that health extension workers are doing. Initially, we had thought of them as being just prevention-focused, but in reality, they are doing some types of treatment, and where you see that going in the future. The other thing is, as we reach saturation with the current cadre of health extension workers, the career pathway for these individuals, these women, because we will be able to, I suspect, retain them, but the career pathway is still very important. And then I was most recently in Ethiopia in August of this year for HIV evaluation, and there was discussion of the urban health extension workers, and I was hoping to hear a little bit more about that because it sounds like a very different kind of program.
Okay, one more question right at the back there, I see, right behind you. Yes.
Hi, I'm Erin Holfelder from the Sabin Vaccine Institute and the Global Network. And I know you touched on HIV, AIDS, TB, and malaria, but I was hoping you could speak to neglected tropical disease burden in your country, as well as efforts underway to combat that burden.
Okay, I think that gives you enough to chew on for a while.
Okay. I think with the neglected, we are trying to address, like, you know, onchocerciasis, guinea worm, trachoma, leishmania, schistosomiasis, schistosoma mansona, and hematobium to some extent. But they're not our focus areas, and we prefer also not to neglect them, but some extent. Because unless we focus, if we try to thinly spread, then I don't think we will have better results in the most important focus areas which I outlined. So that's why I just focused on the major areas. It doesn't mean that we're not addressing the neglected diseases as well. Then with the health extension program, urban HEP, by the way, the curriculum is finished now, and it's different from the rural because for the rural we have used high school graduates and then one-year training. They're ready. For the urban area, we're using nurses, and with 3 to 4 months training on the health extension packages, I think they will be ready. And the whole setup is a bit different because the urban setting is different from the rural setting. But the curriculum is done, and in 2003, since that we will need 3 to 4 months to train them, we can cover a big proportion of our urban areas in 2001, which is 2008, 2009. Gregorian calendar. So it's almost done. Then the career pathway for health extension workers, we have finalized that as well. And by the way, we try to take some experience from Philippines. They have integrated curriculum called step ladder curriculum, and we're working on it. And trying to link health extension workers with nurses, other paramedics, you know, even physicians, and to audit whatever courses they take in that integrated curriculum, then it can help them progress. You know, they can become nurses, they can become health officers or physician assistants, they can go through the MPH, you know, public health masters or PhD, or they can even do medicine, whichever. I mean, they're unstoppable. It depends on, you know, their own capacity. But when we give training, especially, we consider it incentive, and we will provide it to those who are really doing well in their communities. So it will be performance-based. Otherwise, it's almost finalized in collaboration with Ministry of Education, and we will try to give the first few chances to some successful health extension workers who are really doing well. Last week, I have been to one of the villages, and I was talking to one of the health extension workers. She told me that in her village, she had almost all adults tested, older than 15 years old. That's around 2,800. And 16 of them were positive. 8 of them started treatment. And the other 8, their CD4 count is okay, so she's following them on a regular basis. And this is one story, but you have many really excellent stories from good performing health extension workers. That shows really the system can work if we can use the full potential of this health extension program. So they need to be trained and, you know, progress. Then with treatment, of course, they treat malaria and diarrhea, but nothing else. Mary is here. She's interested in pneumonia. we're not for the moment actually including pneumonia, because the whole idea of the health extension program was to focus on health promotion and disease prevention. And in that, there is an issue of attitude. You know, most of us rely more on curative services than health promotion and disease prevention. We give more weight to curative services. And it's true for majority of us. And unless we try, especially at grassroots level, to focus on health promotion and disease prevention, we cannot break that attitude of, you know, leaning toward this curative. So if we give more responsibility to our health extension workers in curative services, they will lean toward this curative and put, what do you call it, that stethoscope and try to go back to that provider-receiver model and not mobilizing the communities to take care of their own problem, rather, you know, force the communities to expect anything from the provider, not just serving themselves. So that's one of the dangers. But in the future, I think many of the families will graduate, you know, in terms of personal hygiene, environmental hygiene, nutrition. It's a lifestyle change. And, you know, preventing HIV, preventing malaria, preventing TB, then they can move towards getting more responsibilities. It could be curative services or additional services which are not covered by the current program. By the way, side by side, we're studying how we can really incorporate some additional curative services, and I hope we can add some in the future, but we will see how we can unload from whatever they're doing now, you know, from the health extension workers. We don't want to put a lot of pressure on them. Then with the health extension workers, maybe it's related to that. So, by the way, nutrition is one of the 16 packages. And we're trying to use, as I said earlier, the health extension workers actually be involved in the current drought, identifying kids, assessing them, helping them, and also referring them cases who are more serious and cannot be handled at their stage. Sorry, I didn't mention it in my presentation, but nutrition is one of the important packages of the 16 packages that's implemented at the health extension program level. And with the drought, I think the, you say the famine, but the under five mortality have shown dramatic improvement. I think it was not famine, by the way. It was drought, according to our definition, and some parts were affected, and this is mainly during the Belgrain. During the Belgrain, by the way, around 10% of the population could be affected. We have two rains, the main rainy season and the, what we call it, the Kremt and the Belg. So even the production in terms of, you know, the various cereals and so on, 90% of it actually is produced during the main harvest season and 10% of it during the Belg. And as a matter of coincidence, the 2003 drought and now are almost same time during the Belg rain, and that affects not more than 10% of the population, which is like 10% of the productivity. So that's why maybe it didn't have huge impact on the under five mortality, because we're talking about a small segment of the population which is affected by the drought. Even this year's drought, it's exactly the same thing. It's affecting the second harvest, the Belg harvest, or the small harvest, not the main harvest. The main harvest, the rain was actually okay, and the harvest season is now, and we expect, you know, things actually to improve. And despite the drought which you mentioned in 2003, the improvement in under five mortality could be because of the magnitude of the drought then, which only affected a small segment of the population and not all. And when you take the number of kids that could be affected, for instance, from the 6.4 million affected now, it's not more than 15% of the population 15 or 16 if the under 5 population, and it's the under 5 which is more vulnerable. So in a country who has more than 75 million population, you know, if you have 6 million affected and the under 5 of that 6 million is really small, and when you do random sampling, I think that will constitute only a small portion of whatever you're going to sample, and it may not have a huge impact. That's one. The other is we have early warning system now, and we try to minimize the impact in terms of deaths. We start early. And as I said earlier, some of the benchmarks of our preparedness, early warning, response, and recovery process is actually from the early warning system of the drought that was installed in Ethiopia more than 10 years ago now. And we have experience in addressing drought and, you know, mobilize forces fast to at least minimize the impact of drought. And maybe that is another reason why we have less impact and better actually status in terms of under 5 mortality. And as I have shown you, this is World Bank report, you know, the sub-Saharan 158, and Ethiopia is less than that. And you can see that it didn't have much impact. And low prevalence, I think it could be a combination of a decrease in HIV incidence in Ethiopia and also improvements in terms of the methods we use, analysis methods for HIV to estimate HIV. In Ethiopia, the estimate some years ago was 6.6%, then declined to 4.4, then 3.5. Now, currently, it's actually the ANC result calibrated by DHS, it's around 2.1%. So, as I said earlier, it's a combination of the methods we use to calculate and also real. There is also real decline, especially in the urban areas. It's decreasing. And especially with the fast expansion of the primary health care, we're doing community conversation almost in all villages now. And community conversation followed by, you know, identifying the real causes, the root causes of the problem for HIV, and also solutions to address them. And I think the knowledge and attitude is really much higher than it used to be. And we're involving almost the whole country now. As I said earlier, it's not really limited to the part of the population because we have now the health extension program really installed almost all over the country, and most of them were already there for 2 to 3 years now. So that may have an impact on the prevalence. And the other is when we started following prevalence, we used to include only mainly urban areas, actually, pregnant women from urban areas. And as you know, we were selecting the most vulnerable part of the population, you know, and not only that, because of the geography, but pregnant women means at least they have, you know, unprotected sex, and you would expect in that category of, you know, population to have higher prevalence. So when you calibrate it using DHS, then you can have lower. But in addition to that, even in our ANC, what we have done is we have included more rural areas, and maybe that could be the reason the prevalence was diluted. Otherwise, we believe that this is the true prevalence. For instance, the village I told you, 2,800 were tested, and 16 were positive, and this is around 0.7%. The rural prevalence, the average prevalence, is now 0.9% for Ethiopia, while the urban is more than 7%. So it's a bit misleading, by the way, when you say 2.1%. The urban areas, population-based, more than 7% is very hot, by the way. But unlike the urban, the rural is very low, 0.9%. But we should not be really misled by that because the urban is very hot. And what you can see from here is, you know, the focus. We need to focus in the urban areas. And now we're focusing on the urban and targeting and really scaling up our intervention, especially in the urban areas, recovering or holding the biggest burden of the problem in the country. But the good news is, if you see it nationally, it's really going down due to several factors, but it doesn't mean that the danger is not there. Still, by any standard, as I said, 7% in urban is really huge. Population-based prevalence we're talking about here. So it's really huge. So I think these were the questions.
Yeah, that covers them very well, very comprehensive. I think we have time for one more set of questions. I see one hand way in the back there and one here in the middle. Yes.
Ann Fitzer from Jopaigo. Dr. Tedros, you said you acknowledged that it will be difficult for Ethiopia to reach the MDG goals for maternal mortality. And yet you do have some very extensive strategies to look at human resources and flooding, and we talked about the career path for health extension workers. I was wondering if in the next health sector development plan, we might not consider looking at the Afghanistan or Indonesia model and having some of the health extension workers be upgraded to community midwives and go through a full training and skilled birth attendance to try and address the maternal mortality problem.
Okay, and a second question was right here.
Thank you. Dr. Magdalena Serpa from Africa's Health in 2010 USAID funded project. Thanks. Thank you, Doctor. I brought a present for you. I have here a picture of a community health extensionist, and I got a health post, and I was really moved by the wonderful work that she's doing. I have several pictures for you. And I'm very happy that you ask about what will happen afterwards, because these are well-trained people, very enthusiastic, and they need a career path. She was emailing me, asking me for the opportunity of continuing her education and in Ethiopia. So congratulations.
Thank you. Let me take the prerogative of the chair and pose a question of my own. Actually, the first question that I have, Dr. Tedros, is a follow-up to the one in the back, or sort of a follow-up, because when you were talking about maternal and infant mortality rates, and then noted that that most women choose to deliver in the villages, I also wondered about why not the heightened midwife training. But also, we all know the great distances that are involved in rural Ethiopia, and if there is a complication, a high-risk birth complication for mother or child, the ability to get to a medical facility is really limited. How much does infrastructure improvement or delivery of people to clinics or hospitals where they can be helped fall into your general plan? I also had a second question, which is probably a very easy one for you to answer. When you were talking about insurance, both non-formal and more formal health insurance, of course, this is a highly debated and contentious issue here in the United States, but is this all government paid for, or are there private and business plans as well, or is it all government paid for? Any other? You've got your chance. We can take a repeat. Yes. This will be the last one.
Years ago, I used to be the health officer in Ethiopia for USAID about 15 years ago. And I remember then we were talking about policy issues regarding the importation of drugs and actually the ministry being taxed to some extent on those importations through the government. When you talk about the new approach to drugs and vaccines and things like that, is there a new policy in terms of taxation or duty on importing drugs and to get more drugs in for a cheaper price, for example, through the ministry?
You mean taxation when we import, lower or higher? Is it? Okay. Yeah? Okay, I can start. I think with the midwives, I agree, and what we have, in our recent evaluation, the number of midwives in Ethiopia is low, and we're trying to address it in two ways. One, as you have rightly said, some of these young health extension workers could go into that profession. And the other option is we're increasing our app intake also. By the way, this year alone, we're deploying 120 midwives, first degree actually graduate. And we have in the pipeline some that can cover most of our hospitals now. And we will try to enroll more to cover our health centers as well. So we will increase our intake, but in addition to that, we will give a chance to our health extension workers who would like to follow that line and as part of their career development, actually. And for the maternal mortality rate, training of midwives or having enough in the system being very important, we're also, we have finalized, by the way, the preparations to train emergency surgery, health officers on emergency surgery. This is a very innovative idea, by the way. We don't have enough surgeons in Ethiopia. And in order to address the problem, we cannot rely on the proper surgeons or the general surgeons. And we're trying to train health officers 2 years, 3 years, and have masters in emergency surgery. Almost 5 universities are now ready. And the target is to train up to 800 in the next 3 to 5 years, and that will cover around 800 primary hospitals or the type A health centers. So we will have at least one emergency surgeon per 100,000 population that can provide comprehensive obstetric care, which is caesarean section at least, and save the lives of mothers actually at that level. This will be really closer to the community. And, of course, we believe that this will minimize the problem that we have. Some people object to this idea because these health officers are not like doctors. This is like training non-doctors on emergency surgery. Although the experience is contrary, during the Second World War, for instance, even France used to train nurses on emergency surgery to do surgical interventions. And when you don't have an option, I think following the only option you have, like using the highly skilled people, will be wrong. It's always good when you cannot satisfy your need using one option through proper, for instance, use of proper surgeons, then it's always good to follow a different path. And this was done, by the way, not only in Europe, even in Africa, in Mozambique, and even in Ethiopia during the civil war. The ruling party now in power used to train nurses and health assistants on emergency surgery, and they were doing very successful surgical interventions. So it's good to use the existing asset or what you can offer to the maximum. Of course, there is the quality issue that many people raise, but you can have at least the bottom line minimum quality met, but at least satisfy the needs of the communities with whatever means that you have at hand, instead of simply waiting or accepting defeat without doing anything. And there was a study actually done by a Swedish from Karolinska Institute, I think, Stefan Bergstrom. He compared the outcomes of operation of 1,000 proper surgeons and 1,000 non-doctors trained on emergency surgery, and the outcome was not significantly different. This is a scientific study. So task shifting is, by the way, one of the strategies now in Ethiopia, and you can shift at least part of what can be done by highly skilled professionals to a mid or low-level skilled professionals, and it can be done by, low or mid-level. Sometimes we tend to really mystify things, but they can be done at low or mid-level. I think we fail when we fail to provide what is at hand. I don't think we can fail when we cannot provide whatever we cannot provide. We cannot provide highly skilled professionals, but at least we can provide something that can save lives by task shifting, by training our health professionals. So the maternal mortality, we're trying to address it using, as you said, enrolling more midwives and using task shifting, training health officers, master's level, and acquiring emergency surgery skills and help mothers instead of, you know, waiting a miracle to happen, you know, waiting for a highly skilled. And we have installed the community-based intervention. I think together we can, with this all, the combination of interventions, we can achieve better results. And we will try our best in the next 7 years to achieve the MDGs. And I believe we can if there is the will, and that's what we're trying to do. Then with the infrastructure, by the way, our government is really has embarked. It's now several years, you know, building roads and so on, because that has a huge impact in saving lives, transporting mothers to where they can get services. So while building primary hospitals or the type A health centers, we are also embarking in building roads and other infrastructures to increase access, because the accessibility, geographic access, and not just building health institutions only, but we need to have to consider the other infrastructures. The career path, I would be happy, you know, the person you spoke to advise her to really perform well, because it's performance-based. Yeah, because we told them, don't expect the training or upgrading or the professional development as a right. It's, you know, it can only be given as an incentive. So they know this, and I would be happy if you can advise her this one so her village can graduate. And we were telling them, you know, please let's have really village by village, you know, graduate, district by district graduate, and the whole state can graduate, and then the whole country. And it's when each and every health extension worker try their best that we can have that. But the opportunity for them is really open. That's how we're developing our human resource strategy, to give them a chance, to give them the opportunity to really grow. No restrictions or no ceiling at all. You know, they can go to whichever line they can go. It's not like one vertical line, but they can grow whichever way based on the interests that they have. And that's what we're trying to tell them every now and then. Just do well, the rest leave it up to us. And we want them to grow. Some of them are really, really bright, and if they can get a chance, they can be, you know, highly skilled professionals. Then with the insurance, by the way, it's going to be a government one, but it doesn't close the idea of the involvement of the private sector as well, but we have tried to focus on this one, because the health insurance will be subsidized by the government, highly subsidized, and also will be subsidized by development partners also. Whatever contribution or as a revenue that will be generated from the communities will really be small, because the paying capacity of our communities is really small, and we wouldn't expect that, you know, the total cost to be covered by the communities. And I don't think this will be attractive for the private sector, at least for the time being, because although there is the willingness to buy, to pay, but the affordability is really low. And something that's really subsidized will not be attractive to the private sector, but we would be happy if the private sector could be involved. But I think the entry will be really slow, because they will be careful and try to weigh how they can benefit from this. But it will continue to be a government system until at least the economy starts to improve and our communities are able to pay and minimize the subsidy. Taxation on drugs, I think it depends, actually. The essential is low, actually. We have local manufacturers who complain about the low tax of drugs we're importing from outside, which is contrary to what you said. And I don't know, of course, they would, whatever level of taxation we would have, the local produce would always want it to be higher. Is it because of that? I don't know. But they think that it's really low. And as infant industry, what our private sector, the local manufacturers are asking the government is actually to increase taxation and to minimize or to zero the import tax for raw materials and to give some incentives or inject some incentives to local manufacturers to protect, you know, what you call this effective protection of infant industries. That's what they're asking for. And one of the complaints they have is this unacceptably low taxes on import drugs. And our government is trying to review that, and we're trying to inject some incentives to them because some of them are facing foreclosure, actually, which is really unfortunate. And we would like to try to help them as much as possible. But it should not be at the expense of our community also, because if they cannot produce enough drugs locally, I mean by giving effective protection for these infant industries, you know, we may also hurt the consumers. Anyway, we will need to strike a balance, and I hope we will, but local production will also be important in a country like Ethiopia, which is really big, and we're trying to encourage that. Thank you.
Thank you. I can't remember when I had heard such a comprehensive and detailed and frank conversation from a government minister. I think we're all very, very pleased that you were able to join us and give us such a wonderful presentation. I do want to take a moment because we have noticed a colleague of ours from the World Bank, Ms. Debrouke Zwedi, who's a HIV/AIDS person there. So just to recognize her at the back of the room, and there's probably several others who we should have. But thank you all for coming and for some wonderful questions. I'm sure the minister really enjoyed it, and we certainly enjoyed you. Thank you.